So, I guess it would be helpful if I had the right piece of paper. I got a lot of stuff, it was cluttering up things, so. Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So I'm going to start out this morning with the process, and it's not going to take very long, but I think it's important that we do it. And that's the process of understanding what a lay Eucharistic minister does and who they are, and also what it means to be a lay minister in other areas of the church. We don't have any acolytes, so the altar guild functions as our acolytes. I have found out that there have been some changes at the diocese, which are good changes. Lay Eucharistic ministers who do not take the sacrament out into the community do not have to do the sexual misconduct training. So you guys are off the hook. Vestry, you still have to take it. So anybody who's interested then in being a worship leader, which is a lay person who is trained and licensed to lead a service. If I'm away and you don't want to invite somebody in, you can want somebody in this congregation could easily do morning prayer. Nobody's going to come and check and knock on the door and say, we heard Barbara's away and you're doing morning prayer and you're not licensed. But anyway, that's just, it'd be kind of nice for that to happen. But anybody is welcome to do that. To be a worship leader, you need to be a communicant in good standing, be faithful in worship, be reliable, punctual, be ability to speak clearly. All kinds of fun stuff. If you want more of that, I'm happy to give it to you. The Book of Common Prayer is something that we don't have here in our chairs. It is an incredible book and worthwhile. If you don't have one, you can go online and read it, or you can get one. They're not terribly expensive. The highlights, besides the fact that it has all the services in here, it also has some wonderful things. It has the Psalms, which were translated specifically for this book, so they might be a tad different than what's in your biblical translation. Same thing, but sometimes they just have some different ways of saying it. But one of the greatest things is the collection of prayers that's at the back of the chart, back of the book, and there's prayers for everything. Sometimes, I don't know about you, but sometimes I just don't know what to say. I'm like, all right, God, you know I need something, so just give it to me, okay? That's not how God operates. So there's a Thanksgiving, and I'm going to, if I can find it really fast, I should have marked it. There's prayers to say after communion. There's prayers to say before communion. There's prayers of thanksgiving. It's just marvelous. It has everything you ever wanted to know about an Episcopal worship service. We have two. There's another one in the office. Feel free to grab it and take a look at it. I don't know what I'd do without mine. All right, so, and then we have a hymnal, which we obviously don't have either, but we have a walking, living hymnal. And that's much, much better. I'm not going to go into the history of the hymnal because probably nobody cares, including me. But if you do care, I have some information here that you can take, and there's always plenty of stuff online.
Barbara,
yes.
I just wanted to add to your Book of Common Prayer info that a friend of mine who went through seminary and was doing a kind of an internship that she needed to do in order to be checked off her list. She was working at an elderly home, and she was not Episcopalian, but she heard through several friends that she should get her hands on a Book of Common Prayer. And she asked me, and I gave her one.
Oh,
and
nice.
She was so thrilled because of all the prayers in it. And that really helped. Because the people she was speaking with and praying with really appreciated that, and they weren't necessarily Episcopalian.
Yeah, it's a beautiful tool for evangelizing people who don't know about our church or about Jesus, period. It also has all the services in it. So I don't know how many of you do a morning devotion when you first get up, but there's the morning prayer. It doesn't take very long. There's a noonday and an evening, and then Compline, which is the last service of the day. Obviously, we don't do all of them necessarily, but they're all there if you want to. In the old prayer book, there really wasn't a lot of that in there, and I'm not sure why people treasured it so much. It mostly had the scriptures that were read for that coming Sunday, but that's another. Let's see. So we all know that the Eucharist is the sacrament of Christ's body and blood, and it's the center of our worship. The term is from the Greek, which is Thanksgiving, and Jesus instituted it on the night when he was betrayed. So it's a very holy act. Those of you who are doing it now are doing a really great job. Just to remind about some of the things, and also if you're interested in doing it, there's no qualifications other than member in good standing and all that good stuff that all of you are. But you know, well, they're not on the altar right now, but there's a chalice, which is for the wine. The thing that goes over the chalice is called a purificator, and that originally they think was to keep the dust or the fruit flies out of the wine. If you're going to build the chalice, there's something called the veil, which goes over it, and then the burse on top, and inside the burse is a secret extra purificator if you happen to need it. We don't do that, and it's fine. We're not required to, but it's a little bit more what you would call high church, whatever that means. But it's kind of fun to know what's going on up there. Just quickly, a tidbit of trivia. If you ask people what the overarching name of our church is, it's the Protestant Episcopal Church in the United States, something like that. But there's some people who are quick to argue that that is not it, that we are the Domestic and Foreign Missionary Society, which is we are also. And it's the official missionary body of the church, and they do a lot of really cool things like help with low interest mortgages, things like that, building. Again, I have lots here if you'd like to. Like three feet. If you're having trouble sleeping at night, this works really well. So the most important thing about from the acolyte stuff. And I have these books, which I thought I had them, and I looked, and then realized this morning that they're here. So, but they are, if you're interested, they're not too expensive. The Acolyte and Reader's Resource Guide and Manual for Lay Eucharistic Ministers. The only thing that we do at St. Francis that's a duty of the Acolyte is lighting these candles. This is the epistle side, and that means it's the side where the first readings happen. And this is the gospel side, where the gospel is read from, and the sermon is usually preached. This candle is always lit first, and this candle is put out first, because it's symbolic that the gospel never stands alone. Again, nobody's going to arrest you if you don't do that. But it's just interesting stuff. All right. So far as being you would be yay if all of you would do it. A lay Eucharistic minister, you're also authorized to administer the sacraments, both the bread and the wine, when there's not enough clergy available. And I've been to some places where the bishop was visiting or there was visiting clergy and they still had the lay ministers participate, and I'm all for that. Yeah, just because somebody's a bishop doesn't mean they get to put, you know, it's any better getting bread from them. Although you wouldn't think so. Sometimes when there's a lot of Episcopalians gathered, they all want to go to the bishop line. I guess they think that bread is more holy. I don't know. And I already told you that those that serve here are not required to take the Safe Church misconduct training. But if you ever decided that you wanted to take the Eucharist out to someone, which you're welcome to do, but you would have to go through that and you'd have to be licensed. So that's something we don't normally do here. I've done it once since I've been here, but it is always an option. And if for some reason you can't make it to church and you want to take the Eucharist, send me a text. I'll be there. Might not be like in the next 5 minutes, but I will come and bring that to you. If you're interested in being licensed as a worship leader, you know, get with me. We have an application to send to the diocese. The bishop has to approve it, and he's not going to not approve it. Going to not approve it. I just got a text for you, from you, Karen. Anyway, and we'll do some more private training. One of the things that either an acolyte or a yay... lay Eucharistic minister is that normally they set the table. In other words, they bring all the elements over and get them ready. Sometimes they actually pour the wine from the cruet. It depends on what the priest wants. But that's a way that we can involve people who want to be involved in the actual service. Skye, who is not here today, but she's getting ready to celebrate a birthday, I talked to her if she'd like to be an acolyte, and she said, yes, indeed, she would. So we'll work on that, and hopefully we'll have an acolyte. Maybe we can get our brothers in here, too. I'm looking at Robert. So the lay Eucharistic ministers are responsible for administering the cup, which is the blood of Christ. And couple things. Number one, never take your hand off that cup. They always should have one hand on it, because as soon as it's out of your hand, it's out of control, and many have been dropped, and it's not fun. So the way we do it with the intinction, the chalice bearer says the words, the offering of the sacrifice of blood, and we work together on that, and that's worked very well, I think. If anybody has any ideas that they would like to change, I'm up for it. At the end, everything is taken off the altar and put on what's called the credence table. And because, you know, dinner is over, a couple of things that are important, but not, well, they are important, is that both kinds of the sacrament should be completely consumed. The second choice is to be honored out to the critters. And the third choice is not to worry about it. But I do worry about it. It's something that's important. So if you're a chalice bearer and you would like to participate in the taking of any of the sacraments, some bread or some wine, you're welcome to do that. Anybody else wants to do it after the service, you're also welcome. But we won't have a long time of people drinking wine and eating bread. you know, could get to be a party. But then the chalice always has a little bit left in it, no matter how much you drink. The instructions are you put a little bit of water in the chalice and swirl it around and drink that, so that you get all of the sacrament. It's perfectly okay to put it outside. It is not okay to throw it in the trash. I just think how many squirrels are holy because of us. Nothing. So, does anybody have any questions? It's just good to remember what some of this stuff is about. If you ever have any questions, I'm happy to help you out. The Red Book, which I am attached to, maybe too much attached to, is just a prayer book, really, with the Eucharist in it and all that. But for some reason, the type and the spacing of the lines just works really well for me with my learning disability. So that's why I have it up there in addition to the bulletin. And sometimes I forget to tell Susan to change something, and so it may not match what's in your bulletin, but it matches what God is calling us to listen to. The Book of Common Prayer asks the question, who are the ministers of the church? And the lay order is the first on the list of ministers. Now, just to break things up a little bit, I told you, I told you, you lost my place, that about the Survivor's Guide, right? I don't think I brought it over. It'll have to wait. There's a Survivor's Guide for when the worst case scenario happens. And it turns out everything in there is actually factual. Things are researched and they work. The one I was going to share with you today was how to tell if a clown is murderous. So don't get near any clowns this week. You just never know. Beware, the end is near. And now that's a phrase that we've heard a lot somewhere along the line, and sometimes is put in a humorous context, when in reality it's really not funny. Jesus warns his disciples and us that we must be vigilant and we must be discerning. The end of the world. Artificial intelligence, I don't know why they care, says about it that people thought the world would end at many different times throughout history. So far, nobody's been right. Why is that? Because only God knows. This is God's thing. If anybody tells you they know the date and time, find me, Satan. The first important one was in the year 1000. People expected Jesus to come back. And then in 2000, we thought all our computers were going to crash and Jesus would show up. And there's nothing in the survival guide for worst case scenario that has anything to do with the end of the world. So I guess we're just on our own. But the end of the world evokes a deep fear among people. And things like, what will I do? What will I be? Where will I go? Will this happen in my lifetime? Think about it, and you get a chance to look back over the gospel. I won't read the whole thing again, but you should get this what I'm saying. The questions and the thoughts and the fears are pretty similar to those of the disciples. This passage comes all the way through time, relevant directly to us, how we feel, how we worry, and how we are called to follow Jesus. Jesus says, don't worry about it. Don't worry about the details or the timing or the substance of it. Don't worry about anything. No one but God knows when the end will come. But no matter what, Jesus is with us. And Jesus will help us when we need to get the courage to speak the truth, when we need to testify against rumors spread by someone who claims that they are the returned Jesus. We are called to reject all of that, not just to walk away from it, but to say what it is that Jesus would have us say. It is our call to tell people, if they, I don't want to do any nasty examples, but you all know when people aren't very nice, like me yesterday when the car pulled in front of me and took my parking place at the soccer game. I did repent. But if we need words, Jesus will provide them for us, and Jesus will stand with us. Sometimes we just don't know what to say as a Christian. So we need to stop. We need to wait. And we need to listen for what it is that Jesus is prompting us to do. I know what you're saying. How do I know Jesus is there? Well, you just have to trust and know that Jesus is there. We all have a choice. We can trust Jesus, or we can go our own way. Now, I've never been particularly successful or satisfied with the results of going my own way. We can choose to bury our head in the sand, or we can become followers of those first disciples, and do what they did and proclaim the gospel. We can also choose to be followers of those people who say they know. They know about the end. They know the truth about everything in the Bible. They've got it down pat. Well, you go, but I'm not going with you. I'm not saying that not everything that we understand is understandable in the words of the Bible, if that makes sense. But we can study it, and we can ponder on it, and we can find it to be informative and useful in our spiritual life. Those people who claim to be prophets use fear as their bait. When I worked at Beaumont Correctional Center as a chaplain, there was a group that came in, and they were very dedicated. They came every week, and they were motorcycle guys, tattoos and leather vests and the whole stereotypical image. But they would teach the Bible to these young men and teach it well. The thing that bothered me about this group was at the end of their Bible study, they always said, "All right, come up now and accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, because if you don't, you die tonight, you're going to hell." That is not the way to convert a teenager. But it does demonstrate how important the idea, the conversation, the questions about what it will be like when Jesus comes and judges. We don't know exactly, but we need to be prepared for it, whatever it is. We need to stop, and we need to look, and we need to listen. We can also choose to blame God for all the evil in the world, or we can do something about it. And that's going to be a personal thing, something that's going on in the world that bothers you. What can you do about it? One of the things that we do here is provide food for the people at Goochlin Cares. That is ministry. That is taking care of our brothers and sisters that can't take care of ourselves. What we can do is to find opportunities to share the promise of Jesus, which is the promise of everlasting life. They asked him, "Teacher, when will this be, and what will be the sign that this is about to take place?" And he said, "Beware that you are not led astray. For many will come in my name and say, 'I am he,' and the time is near. Do not go after them." Sometimes these opportunities come out of a situation of suffering. Jesus never said that following him would be easy. And sometimes we find that our best opportunities and our best changes come out of suffering. We learn a lot from suffering. Now, it's not fun, of course, but it's important in our spiritual life to understand that we will suffer as Jesus suffered. So this is one of my commentaries, and the story was in it. I'm going to share it with you because it's pretty wow. Thomas Dorsey was born in 1889 in rural Georgia, was a prolific songwriter and an excellent gospel and blues musician. While a young man, Dorsey moved to Chicago and found work as a piano player in the churches, as well as in clubs and playing in theaters. Struggling to support his family, Dorsey divided his time between playing in the clubs and playing in the church. After some turbulence, Dorsey devoted his artistry exclusively to the church. In August of 1932, Dorsey left his pregnant wife in Chicago and traveled to be the featured soloist at a large revival meeting in St. Louis. After the first night of the revival, Dorsey sent a telegram that simply said, "Your wife just died." Dorsey raced home and learned that his wife had given birth to a son before dying in childbirth. The next day, his son died as well. Dorsey buried his wife and son in the same casket and withdrew in sorrow and agony from his family and friends. He refused to compose or play any music for quite some time. While still in the midst of despair, Dorsey said that as he sat in front of a piano, the feeling of peace washed over him and through him, and he heard a melody in his head, a melody he'd never heard before, and he began to play it. That night, Dorsey recorded this testimony while in the midst of suffering. "Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me home." Some of you might know that as a musical offering. I will not sing it for you. I apologize for that. So the gist of what I'm saying is that we need to prepare. We need to watch. We need to go know what's going on. We don't know when Jesus will come again. But I sure don't want to be caught following some guy who's charging me $50 a week to follow him or her around for some bizarre ministry. And there are people that do that. The important thing is to stay focused on Jesus. The important things are listed in the collect for today, which is really amazing. It tells us what to do. "Blessed Lord, who caused all holy scriptures to be written for our learning, grant us so to hear them, read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, that we may embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life." That's what you did when you gave us Jesus. You gave us hope. And we thank you for it. So we need to get to work for Jesus. We need to be his hands and feet in the world. We need to carry the light of Christ in the world. Amen.